Thank you. I see a lot of you here today. I'm surprised because I thought you were all going to be drunk and in bed this morning, but very nice to see eager young minds. So as Kenny said, I'm going to, or Harris said, I'm going to speak about immigration. And I don't know how many of you have heard this story about, you know, FDR, that he was speaking one time before this group called the Daughters of American Revolution, which is a lineage-based outfit. Like, so you have to be connected with somebody who was present at the time of the revolution to be a member of this organization. And he greeted them all by saying, "My fellow immigrants." And actually, as it turns out, the story is completely false. He never said that. And which is a good thing for me, because I can use this greeting now at this gathering and not be accused of quoting FDR and offending and offending any libertarian. And I guess there are a couple of you in this room here today. So my fellow immigrants, there is actually no issue that I write about. And as Harris said, I write about a whole host of issues. There is no issue I write about that generates quite as much hot passion as immigration does. I mean, it is the most controversial issue of the day. And the interesting thing about my readers is that, you know, and the restrictionist readers from whom I get a lot of hate mail, it is that they don't actually fall along, you know, racial, ethnic lines. So they are not all, you know, white, Anglo-Saxon, Protestant males. They actually are pretty racially diverse. So, you know, I have, they represent sort of this cross-section of American society, and there are Jews, Catholics, Chinese, Indians. I mean, I get hate mail from every possible ethnic group. And what's true of my readers is actually quite true of the pundits and the advocates of the more restrictionist position. So if you, you know, think about it, the Center for Immigration Studies, which is the key restrictionist outfit that advocates a total moratorium on all immigration, legal and illegal, it's run by an Armenian American. And you have Ramesh Panduru, who writes for National Review, which has a long-standing history of opposing, you know, more relaxed liberal immigration policies, and he's an Indian American. And then you have Michelle Malkin, who's a Filipino descent. And, you know, she can trot out anti-immigration tropes with the best of them. And, you know, so it is not an issue which actually is driven by racism, in my view. It is, there's something else going on over here. And I think, you know, what's interesting is that all these people were immigrants, and they come over here and they immediately want to pull the drawbridge to the next batch of immigrants. There is, I think, anti-immigration sentiment sort of appeals to a certain tribalism in us. You know, once we become members of the Club of United States of America, we don't want to dilute, you know, that membership by just allowing anybody to come to the country. And so there is, I think, something like that which is driving this sentiment. But that aside, I mean, I'm not here to psychologize my opponents. I'm here to actually make a libertarian case for immigration, or more open immigration. And so far, you know, the mainstream pro-immigration case that you hear falls along two lines. There's the conservative case for immigration, and then there's a liberal case for immigration. And the conservatives who defend immigration, they do so on economic grounds. It's good for our economy. And liberals who defend immigration, they defend it on humanitarian grounds. You know, we've got to do this. It's, you know, we have to help out the world. But for libertarians, the fundamental reason to support open borders is that it's the only position that's consistent with limited government. You know, that's the case we are interested in hearing. And we want, and both negative, negative liberty that minimizes government intrusion in our lives, as well as positive liberty in the sense of pursuing our own happiness, you know, sort of the Jeffersonian sense. And I mean positive liberty here, I don't mean positive rights. And so don't in the question and answer session ask me if I, you know, want to get immigrants over here because we should be spreading our wealth around. That's not my point. So I'm going to make a few quick observations about the conservative, the economic case for liberty, and the humanitarian, the liberal case for liberty, and then I'll make the libertarian case for liberty, point out, you know, what some of the shortcomings are in these positions. So, you know, if you consider the economic case for liberty, I mean, we hear horror stories about how Americans, American workers are constantly losing their jobs to low-wage immigrants, that these immigrants depress American wages, and you know what have you. And the interesting thing here is that the economist whose work opponents of open borders like to cite as a Cuban American. You know, that goes again to, you know, immigrants themselves are opposed to immigration. And his name is George Borjas. How many of you have heard of him? Okay, yeah. So George Borjas, who is a Harvard economist, smart guy, he is the one who's been making the most potent economic case against immigration. But even Borjas admits that immigrants make a $7 billion net contribution. Now this is, you know, to the economy. This is far lower than what you know, most economists put it at. It's close to $25 billion, according to most economists. But you know, all of that aside, I mean, you know, we don't need to be, you know, you can debate what the precise contribution is of immigrants to the economy, but you can't doubt that they in fact do make a contribution to the economy. Because insofar as immigrants have jobs, it is because they are producing more value for their employers than they are consuming in wages and benefits. It's only when they produce value are they going to get jobs. And so the fact that they have jobs should tell us that, you know, they are beneficial. And they are more beneficial to the employer than the alternatives for the employer. So if the employer were to hire native borns or to get some machine to do that job, that would be less advantageous for the employer than hiring this immigrant. That's why this immigrant has a job. And so whatever the dislocations and the hardships that immigration might cause to specific groups of Americans, on the whole, for the economy, it produces net benefits. And in this sense, you know, immigration is like trade. There are some losers, specific losers, but on the whole, you know, most people are better off. But there is one objection to these comments that people make, and it should be addressed, which is that you know, this would be true that immigrants are producing net value for the economy if we didn't have a welfare state. But when you have a welfare state, essentially what you're doing is you're privatizing the benefits of immigration for the employers, to the employers, but you're socializing the costs. Because employers don't have to pay immigrants everything, you know, that the immigrants need, because they are collecting, you know, various welfare services. And so therefore, the taxpayers are picking up the cost of immigrants. Now, this is, I mean, this is not an argument that we should simply dismiss. It's a serious argument. But the fact of the matter is that every empirical study that has been done on this question has found out that, A, in America, the welfare state is simply not big enough, as it is in Europe, to be a major draw for immigrants. And this was true even before the 1996 immigration reform bill. Which actually, after that immigration reform bill was passed, immigrants were denied, now all kinds of mean-tested benefits they are not eligible for. So they are not eligible for food stamps, they are not eligible for all kinds of health care and what have you. But even before this welfare law was passed, Julian Simon had, and how many of you are familiar with Julian Simon? Yeah, he had done actually one of the most definitive studies on immigration and welfare. And he had found that on balance, immigrants consume less in welfare than native-born populations, and they produce far more in benefits than they consume in welfare. But you know, even if the welfare state were to become a draw for immigrants, what would the answer be? The answer would be to get rid of the welfare state, right? I mean, not get rid of immigration. But that's not an argument you hear very much. And in fact, is there anybody from the Cato Institute over here? No, okay, well then good, I can beat up on the Cato Institute. So, you know, even the Cato Institute, I mean, their position is immigration, yes, welfare, no. And, you know, on the surface it sort of makes sense, but I actually don't support that position, and if any of you are interested, you can ask me in the Q&A why. I think that's not a good position to have. So, but quite apart from the benefits to the American economy, what I've labeled sort of the conservative economic argument for immigration, there are also strong humanitarian arguments for immigration, the liberal argument. If you think of the two major, you know, our foreign policy and our aid to foreign countries, both of those are driven by humanitarian concerns to a very great extent. And both of those would be better served just if we opened the borders and had a more open immigration policies. So if you think about it, you know, the liberating the oppressed has been at least part of the rationale behind nearly every major war of the last 100 years. World War II, you know, that was one reason. Korea, Vietnam, Balkans, Iraq, all of these wars. One of the arguments that the, you know, defense establishment was making was that those awful tyrants are doing awful things to their people and we've got to do something about it. Now in Iraq, of course, you know, we heard this argument a lot that, you know, we went in there because we wanted to remove the boot of Saddam Hussein from the neck of his people. That was one of the core justifications of the war. And so in this war, US has lost 4,000 of its soldiers and it has spent hundreds of billions of dollars, you know, in fighting this war. But if liberating people from tyranny was such an important goal of the Iraq war, then instead of sending American soldiers and guns to Iraq, we should have just been giving visas to Iraqis to come over here, right? I mean, you liberate them very quickly, you do that. I mean, that's what happened in East Germany, for example. You know, we had been fighting the Cold War for a long time, but then what actually ended the communist dictatorship? The Berlin Wall came down, the East Germans, they're in mass migration to West Germany, and suddenly the whole communist apparatus, you know, their Stasi and their, you know, entire police state kind of crumbled because it didn't have any victims left, you know, to tyrannize. And so giving people an exit option is sort of the, you know, the best, the cheapest way to be humanitarian. But, you know, they're quite remarkably, you know, after the Iraq war started, you know, there were Iraqis who were helping coalition forces, you know, telling them who the bad guys were and what have you, and they were facing persecution in Iraq. You know, that there were the Sunnis who were going after the Shiites, Shiites going after the Sunnis for collaborating with the United States. And these people wanted to flee somewhere. They wanted their two million of them actually fled Iraq. And you know how many the Bush administration took in? Any wild guesses here? No, they took in 500 in the first 4 years of the war. They gave, you know, asylum to 500 people. And after a great deal of international outrage and pressure, they increased that number to the grand total of 7,000. So that's about how many, you know, Iraqis we have taken in. So it's kind of, it's just kind of boggles the mind. But just as American guns are not the most effective way of helping people living under tyranny, American aid is not the most effective way of helping people living under poverty. So every year the United States gives about $28 billion in aid to foreign countries. And we know what happens to that aid. It goes, you know, into the pockets of their kleptocratic rulers. Very little of it actually reaches its intended audience. By contrast, if you had a generous work visa program in the United States, it would cost the US government nothing. It would actually produce economic benefits for us. And it would, you know, help the poor people in third world countries. And my former Reason colleague, Kerry Howley, actually, she wrote a very good column one time. And she kind of summed this point up beautifully. And this is what she said. She said, there is no development policy, no feasible amount of foreign aid, no poundage of fair trade coffee that will help someone from a developing country to a better life than opening the door to a better economy, instantly doubling or tripling the value of their labor. That's essentially, you know, what you do. They cross the border and the same, you know, labor, the price of it goes up three or four times. So immigration, in fact, is the best anti-poverty program, and it doesn't, again, cost us anything. So those are all, you know, pretty good arguments that open immigration policies simultaneously improve the American economy, improve the lives of the world's, you know, poor and destitute, those huddled masses that the Statue of Liberty refers to. But from the standpoint of libertarians, what's most important is that only such policies are consistent with limited government. Open immigration policies are not ultimately about helping immigrants, but protecting the rights and liberties of Americans themselves. And I think this point has been emphasized nearly not enough in this immigration debate, and I think that is actually, you know, one of the reasons why we are at a political stalemate. You know, we just haven't seen any movement in opening up our immigration policies. Now, liberal advocates of immigration make it sound like open immigration is all about the rights of immigrants. And that makes it very easy for conservatives to sort of portray them as, you know, pro-immigration, bleeding heart, you know, sort of advocates, you know, who just want to spread America's largesse around. And so, you know, and that doesn't, so both sides are kind of stuck over here. Now, if the, you know, the, I think a consistently libertarian position that shows that, you know, open borders is about protecting the rights of Americans themselves, you know, it's a very powerful moral argument. I mean, this is, you know, one of those political opportunities where I think, you know, libertarians can seize the moral high ground and, you know, appear like children of Solomon, you know, like we are these wise people and you benighted conservatives and liberals fighting at each other on the wrong terms. And we can sort of reestablish the terms of the debate over here. So, but what is the kind of case that we would have to make? I mean, so I'll sort of lay out an argument that we could use politically to sort of change the terms of the debate. The first is a very Hayekian argument. You know, Hayek argued very powerfully that when government interferes with the peaceful, voluntary activity of individuals to achieve some collectivist end, and it doesn't matter whether that end is, you know, a conservative end, like protecting, you know, preserving your culture, or whether it is a liberal end, like more equality, that, you know, when you pursue collectivist ends, you inevitably, you know, unleash unintended consequences. And the government, when the government fails to achieve its ends, this is not perceived as evidence that there is something wrong in these ends themselves. It is always seen as that we didn't use sufficient force to, you know, achieve these ends, and these efforts are redoubled, and then you're on your way, you know, to the road to serfdom. And this is the logic that has played out in the war on drugs, for instance. The ban on drugs is not stopping people from buying drugs. It has just spawned an illegal trade in drugs. This is the logic, by the way, that has also played out on the war on high-flow toilets. I don't know how many of you are aware of this. But in Michigan, some years ago, the government actually banned high-flow toilets because they used up too much water. And so what did Michigan citizens do? They would go across the border to Canada. They would buy their high-flow toilets. They would sneak them under the noses, you know, of the customs officials, didn't produce a stink, and they would have their high-flow toilets. So there was a smuggling ring in high-flow toilets in Michigan for a long time. So, and this is kind of the logic that is playing out right now on immigration. You know, we are militarizing the southern border. It's like we built a, you know, we are building a Berlin Wall on the Rio Grande. And it's all because we want to prevent willing employers from hiring willing workers. So so that's a pretty good Hayekian argument against, you know, restricted borders. But, you know, but then we also have to go further and we have to lay out what would a principled libertarian immigration policy look like in a world of nation states where borders are not going to be scrapped anytime soon. And we can't just simply throw open the borders and say everybody in. It's politically just not going to go anywhere. So I think what we can realistically strive for is building a presumption for liberty in our immigration laws. That's, I think, where we have to go with this. So what do I mean by this? So right now, the best way to think about American immigration policy is that Americans have to justify to their government why they want to bring someone to the country. And I think it should be the other way around. I think the government should have to justify to us, you know, why we shouldn't be allowed to bring somebody to the country, either because they pose a public health threat or they pose a security threat or what have you. And if the government can't make that case to us, then we should be able to bring anybody into the country, you know, and we shouldn't have to explain ourselves to the government. This is not as wacky as it sounds, because this was actually the US immigration policy till, you know, 1930, there where we had virtually open borders. People would just show up on Ellis Island, and if they were sound of health and didn't have a criminal background, they would be issued a visa right there, and they would be in. There would be actually employers standing in line to hire these guys when they got off the ship. So it was a very efficient program. That's not how things work anymore. The way to think about our immigration policy is now there is a blanket ban on immigration, and then the government creates various categories, allowing us to, you know, relaxing the ban in these specific categories that it has created. And so I'll go over some of these categories to just show to you how crazy the system is if you think about it rationally. Consider the category of asylum, for instance, and asylum applies to people, you know, who are trying to flee persecution. Now, actually, it's very strange, but only the government can grant asylum. So, you know, if you have a friend or a relative who's stuck in Iraq and Saddam Hussein wants to kill him, you can't sponsor this person to bring them to the United States. So, and if you try to help this person, you know, flee Iraq and come to the United States, you can actually be prosecuted yourself. So this is like, think about how bizarre this whole thing is, that American government can send you forcibly to Iraq to liberate people in Iraq, but if you want to bring somebody of your own free will, well, then you're going to be arrested. I mean, that's how, you know, crazy our asylum laws are. But take another category of family-based immigration. The government bars Americans from sponsoring family members unless they are blood relatives or spouses. The spouses must be of the opposite sex. Gay partners need not apply. Even among blood relatives, the US government decides who gets priority and who doesn't. So minor children, it's fairly easy. But if you have a child who is over 21 years old, then it's very difficult. If you have cousins who want to come, that's out of the question. And if you want to, you know, invite a close friend to come and live with you over here, that's just not even in their category. So, you know, so that's not just not possible. And so essentially, these immigration policies are not violating the rights of immigrants as much as they are violating the rights of Americans who want to bring people over here for whatever reason. This becomes even clearer if you consider employment-based immigration. I mean, most Americans don't quite relate to family-based immigration because, you know, they don't have enough people outside the country whom they want to bring in. But employment-based immigration affects everybody. The government caps the number of high-skilled work visas, you know, that it issues every year to 85,000. Before the recession, this was about half of what various companies needed, and the application for this visa would be opened on April 1st, and it would be filled within 2 days the cap would be reached. And then the companies would have to wait for another year before they could apply. I mean, this is, you know, and this is for high-skilled immigration. For low-skilled immigration, you know, construction companies or house cleaning or landscaping companies or farmers or what have you, you know, who employ unskilled workers, there are literally no categories available for them to bring in workers. So there is no surprise that, you know, you have so many employers who are just breaking the law and hiring people illegally. And so whose rights are our immigration policies violating? It's the rights of our employers, right? But instead of, and you know, here then you see how the road to serfdom logic is playing out in all of these categories. So instead of relaxing America's immigration laws in the face of this widespread non-compliance that you have in certain sectors of the economy, the government is actually like redoubling its efforts to stop them from hiring these workers. So one of the, you know, programs that has been enacted now, and this is the latest buzzword in immigration circles now is interior enforcement. And interior enforcement, essentially what that means is that we are going to make the life of illegal immigrants over here so miserable and the people who hire them, you know, so difficult that these people will leave voluntarily on their own. That the government won't even have to take, you know, draconian deportation measures. These people will just leave on their own. And so in order to do that, the government has put in place something called the E-Verify program, which will require employers, every time they hire anybody, to check this person's eligibility for work in a federal database. And if they can't find this person in the federal database, well, then they are not eligible to work. Now, you can't have a specific program just for immigrants. Every American's name will be in this database. So essentially, what the government is asking is that every American has to get a permission slip for work before they can get employed, because their employers have to verify whether or not you are immigrant or non-immigrant, and if you're an immigrant, whether you're allowed to work. But Congress is actually not the only entity, you know, which is sort of getting into this business of making the life of immigrants and their employers, you know, really miserable. You've all heard of the Arizona law. How many of you have heard of the Arizona law? Okay, good. So a fair amount number of you. So essentially what the Arizona gained a lot of notoriety last year when it passed this law, which will authorize, you know, police and other law, you know, enforcement officials to just stop anybody on, you know, who looks suspicious to them and ask them to produce their immigration papers to prove their legal residency. Now, you know, they say they are only going to, you know, go after people who pose a reasonable suspicion. But who poses a reasonable suspicion? Anybody, you know, who's brown-skinned and has an accent. So it's not just immigrants. There are, you know, I'm a U.S. citizen, and I am brown-skinned, and I have an accent. If I were in Arizona, I could be stopped, you know, and asked to produce my papers. Now, this is a kind of you know, your papers please policy. When do you know when we saw this? Nazi Germany. I mean, I hate to use, you know, make comparisons with, you know, Nazi Germany, but, you know, that's where this law was, you know, most consistently applied. And so you, I mean, so you see Hayek's argument in work over here, his logic in work over here. You start with wanting to restrict immigration for just immigrants, and you end up swallowing the whole Bill of Rights. So I think these, you know, these are the kinds of arguments I think would have a great deal of cachet with the American public if we made them. That we are all going to be collateral damage in this war on illegal immigrants that the US government has decided to launch. Now, before I go on to the next part, I just want to actually take up this one objection to my argument that that libertarians actually make. And one of these libertarians is this guy, Hans Hermann Hoppe. You guys heard of him? Yeah, Hoppe, yeah, okay. The Journal of Libertarian Studies in 2007 had actually done like a whole issue on open borders and immigration, and Hoppe had come out on the other side, on the restrictionist side, and he actually made some pretty ingenious arguments. So this is what Hopper's argument was. He said that in a free society, if people, you know, he agrees they ought to be left alone to associate with whoever they choose and not associate with whom they don't choose. But that's not possible in a quasi-socialist country such as ours, because the government owns roads, parks, utilities. Taxpayers have no way of denying access to those whom they find objectionable. So furthermore, anti-discrimination laws that our government put in place after the Civil Rights Act force private establishments such as restaurants to admit people against their will and employers to hire people they don't want to hire. And even worse, public schools and a rampant welfare state forces taxpayers to subsidize habits and lifestyles that they might find objectionable. And so he says, under these circumstances, if you allow open immigration, what you're essentially doing is you are coercing integration. So open immigration leads to coerced integration. And that, he thinks, is, you know, not very libertarian. So so is that a good argument? I actually don't think so. And I would be interested in hearing your thoughts, you know, in the Q&A. Now, the quarrel that libertarians like Hoppe have against, you know, this forced integration argument that they make is, I think, ultimately, it's not against immigration. You know, it is an argument against any changes in population or demographics. So what do I mean by this? Essentially, every argument that they make against immigration can also be made against children. Childbirth, as it were, is the primary form of immigration, right? That's how children, you know, that's how we gain access to a whole new group of people. And we can confidently predict that many children born today will grow up to be objectionable adults. And some of you are here, I know. And they will be objectionable adults whom many taxpayers will subsidize against their will and better judgment. All these children will use public roads, and a vast majority of them will go to public schools. And some of them will also wind up on welfare. A few might become criminals, or even worse, they might vote for Democrats. And if they are members of certain minorities, they will benefit from affirmative action programs and forced hiring laws, right? Yet nobody would argue that empowering the government to restrict childbirth, especially of inner city minorities, is an advance in liberty, right? I mean, but that's essentially what Hoppe is arguing. If that is the case, if, you know, if we are not going to prevent inner city minorities from having children, by what logic can we prevent, say, a Chinese citizen from getting five family members from China? I mean, the argument is essentially the same. But Walter Block, who is a professor at Loyola University, he actually has another very good argument to reject the, you know, the Hoppean position. And this is what his argument is. He says, it is undeniable that in our current system, you know, opening the borders will force some taxpayers to pay for immigrants they don't want. But by the same token, closing the borders will force other taxpayers to finance measures to restrict entry of people whom they do want to bring in, right? I mean, so there is a rights violation either way. So given that perfect justice is not possible in this system of, you know, this quasi-mixed system that we have, the issue from a libertarian standpoint becomes which of these two policies is going to lend itself to expanding, you know, to expanding the scope and power of government the least. So, you know, do we, you know, move towards a limited government position if we close the borders or open the borders? And those who doubt that an open border policy is best on this count are to consider this. A state that is powerful enough to prevent people from coming in is also powerful enough to prevent people from going out. And there is such a state that exists, which has, you know, this perfect control of its borders, and it is called North Korea. And North Korea is the ultimate serfdom, right? So I don't think the Hoppean position, therefore, you know, lends itself to more liberty on its own terms. So now it's just in conclusion. So I had promised you that I was going to make not just the negative case for liberty, but also make an affirmative, a positive case for liberty. And this case rests on this, you know, the Jeffersonian promise that we all have a right to pursue our happiness in this positive sense, that we, you know, need to be able to maximize our opportunities, pursue them as we see fit. America is a nation of immigrants, and it's been built by immigrants. But actually, in no time in this country's history has open immigration been more important than today. That's because, you know, in a globalized world, Americans' opportunities are going to lie less within their own borders and more outside the borders. You know, America's vast size has kind of historically offered Americans plenty of opportunities at home, you know, to find jobs, open companies, marry whoever they want to, and, you know, what have you. And so America's exploration missions, unlike those in Europe, have been to outer space. You know, Vasco da Gama and Christopher Columbus, you know, they scoped the world to look for opportunities outside their own borders. But the American continent is so huge that we never really had to do that until now. Now in a globalized world, you know, companies, American companies are establishing offices elsewhere. They have, you know, and they want to put Americans in other countries. So as Americans, you know, expand out of America, they are going to meet other people. You know, they are going to form strong bonds. Your generation is going to be, I predict, forming strong bonds with people, you know, outside their country. Occasionally, you know, you'll form friendships, you'll fall in love, you know, you'll like the food of people outside this country, you will want to bring their chefs over here to open restaurants with them. None of that is going to be possible if we have the kind of immigration system, you know, that we have right now. So in short, you know, in this world of extended horizons, you will find that the people who best meet your needs for work, entertainment, and love live not next door or in the next city or in the next state, but in different countries. And if you let anachronistic immigration policies stand in your way, this will fundamentally compromise Jefferson's promise to create an America where you can pursue your own happiness as you see fit. And there is something, you know, really wrong with that. So you guys should not put up with it. That's my